Hello, this is the Black and Asian Therapist Network podcast. My name is Eugene Ellis. This is the second of two podcasts. In the first podcast, I spoke with two therapists that attended extra training to supplement the training that they had originally received when they became psychotherapists. They did this so that they could facilitate dialogue about Black issues with their trainees and their clients. I spoke with Chris Black, who is the clinical director at Kids Inspire, and who identifies as a Black therapist, and Celia Levy, who is the counselling services manager at City Lit, and who identifies as a white therapist. Both therapists gave insightful and powerful accounts of their experience of doing this extra training and their journey of overcoming the powerful feelings that can get activated when uncovering issues of race in the therapeutic process. You might want to go back to the previous podcast and listen to Chris and Celia and also gain a sense of the issues that Black and Asian students on therapy courses experience. In this podcast, I'll be talking to two other guests who are also therapists, one who identifies as Black and one who identifies as white. They have both attended the Black Issues training that has been entitled A Can of Worms and talk about their experience and how it has affected their work. My guests will be talking about concepts like ancestral baggage and shadism, which are not gone into in any great detail, but if you want to find out more about these ideas, I'll give you details at the end of the podcast. My first guest then is Pat Marie Coleman. Pat Marie is a counsellor and supervisor in higher education and a course tutor for the counselling programme at City Lit. Pat Marie contrasts her experience as a student, where she felt her voice was silenced both by herself and by others, and how this made her furious to the point of wanting to leave the course. And now as a tutor, how she's finding ways to facilitate her Black and Asian students to find their voice in the therapeutic setting. The very act of finding her voice is empowering others, both Black and white, to find theirs. I went to meet Pat Marie at City Lit. Thank you, Pat Marie, for agreeing to be part of this podcast. I know that you've done some of the training Barton has organised, and you identify as a Black woman. I'd like to start off by asking you, what drew you to top up your training in this particular area?
I think there are a few reasons. I've done two lots of the training, so I did the first lot 2 years ago, or some of the days, and now I've just recently done part two of it.
Yeah.
Initially, I was in the middle of studying on an MSc course, and as a student, I'd had experienced a lot of issues that I found quite difficult in terms of looking at this stuff.
Yeah.
And was quite surprised that still the same issues. I did my initial training, completed it in 94, and actually felt that the issues were dealt with in a better way than on my MSc, actually. But I'm much more aware and much more experienced now, so maybe it also is that I'm experiencing things differently. I wanted to look at how you, and I also teach counselling skills, I wanted to look at how you support students and tutors in talking about these issues.
Yes.
Because they're really emotive.
Yeah.
And always bring up lots of stuff.
Yeah.
That is quite difficult to contain and also support a dialogue around it. How do I find my voice? Because I found my voice was silenced on the course.
Okay.
By myself and by others. And how to facilitate that as a tutor.
Mm.
And still be present and learn and all those things.
So was that how it felt? Was that the main feeling or response? Silence? Or was there other things happening as well?
Oh, no.
Okay.
This wasn't the only... As a student, I was furious, angry. I thought about leaving the course.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And so it really made me think about my students and how do they feel. Because I'm in this dilemma. I feel like I'm in a dilemma as a tutor on the course, as if I support the Black students too much, it may be seen as giving them preferential treatment.
Yeah.
But actually, if they're not supported, they're on their own and they're silenced.
Yes, yes.
I'm struggling with that, but I think I'm much more present.
Yes.
Because
yes.
I've done the training, I'm much more present.
Mm.
I was aware of the issues before, but now I'm able to be, I'm less silenced.
Yes.
So even as a tutor, I was silenced in a way.
You might have felt you were giving the black students preferential treatment. Was that echoed in with the white students and white tutors? Did they?
No, I don't think I've verbally had that feedback. No, I don't think so.
Right.
I certainly have had white students who have felt very differently when I've talked about black issues. You know, there's a whole thing about shame and guilt. It has such an impact.
It does.
And then it has an impact on their relationship with me. I think less on my relationship with them.
Yes, right.
Yeah. It's like opening Pandora's box, talking about it.
Yeah, it's the can of worms.
Yeah, the can of worms, absolutely.
That's a training phrase.
Yeah, it's a really good name for it.
Yeah. In the training you were doing back in 94, it sounded like a bit of a crisis in terms of whether you're going to continue with the course or not.
Oh, no, that was the training I've done recently. This is my MSc course. No, in 94, I felt really heard. What happened on my initial training was I was finding my voice, but I wasn't very articulate. So one of the things that I did on my course, which caused a huge disruption, I organised a social meeting for just the black students to talk about black issues. But I did it in a quite underhand way because I didn't have the voice to say it in the group. So I approached the black students separately. Then what happened was the white students found out and it kind of caused a lot of division in the group. So what some white students were really supportive, felt it was really right on for us black students to get together. And others just couldn't understand why we would need to. So, yes, I've been causing controversy for a long time. And actually, a similar thing happened on my MSc. I asked, on a residential, when I was feeling really empowered, I asked that we have a black group. And we did have a black group. And in a different way, openly to the whole group. And we did have a black group. And then there was a lot of fallout afterwards. So, you know, that's really interesting, isn't it?
Yes. Why do you need to meet up separately? I mean, I've had that experience where I've trained, where I've got together some black and Asian students who were doing the course at the time, same time as I was doing it. And a similar response. Again, some supportive and some, I don't even understand, why are you meeting? What's the point? And then feeling excluded sometimes as well from that.
I think it was really difficult for the other, on my MSc, the other black students, they wanted to be, I don't think they wanted to be separated. I mean, this is my perception. Because we didn't really process it. But I don't think they wanted to be separated. And so one by one, we'd all agreed to meet up. And one by one, they all said, no, we're not doing that again. But, you know, that's about the impact on the bigger group and about them as individuals.
It sounds like the silence and all of the other things that you just spoke about are about people not feeling safe. And if you're not feeling safe, then obviously exploration becomes problematic in an attachment sense. What was the actual training that you went on with Aisha, you know, the two trainings? Did you feel safe? Did you feel okay to explore? Were there things that made you feel unsafe?
I have supervision with Aisha and Aisha's book actually saved me on my MSc course. I wrote an essay based on it. I did some research. I did a project, did a presentation, really immersed myself into it. So felt very safe. And the second lot of training went to quite a deep level for me. It's very emotional. Amazing. I'm still actually kind of processing what came up for me. And that was really important. The first lot of training 2 years ago, I think I was quieter. I was more vocal in this second lot of training. But again, I felt safe and it was interesting. It was a bigger group. It was a different feel. It was a bigger group the first lot of training. Smaller group the second lot. So I was much more vocal.
Yeah, I mean, the second training went a bit deeper. I mean, the first training was just, well, not just, but it was talking about the basic ideas and the theories and stuff. The second training, you felt you sort of came out and found your voice more in this.
Absolutely.
In this
found my voice. It reinforced things that I knew and have talked about on a kind of cognitive level, but I really felt them, really, you know, internalised racism, things that have been said in my family, things I've just heard all through my life.
Mm.
It was a real opportunity to explore that and what it means to me and the impact on me and my relationships.
Yeah. The training itself, I mean, did you take away anything in particular? Yeah, what gems did you sort of pick up along the way, and did you use those in your work as a trainer?
It's been quite recent, but I think I definitely will be using it. I've done this exercise with my students, and I've also observed it being done in terms of power.
Mm.
But we did this exercise where we stood in a line in terms of colour,
right.
Shadism. So we looked at, and so there was this long line of us starting from white to black and all the variations in between.
Mm.
And it was amazing. It had such a huge impact. That's when I really kind of broke down. Because then all of that stuff that I've grown up with came through.
Mm.
Really felt it. So I would like to definitely do that with my students at some point.
Okay. Well, that was something you done on the training.
On
with
the
Aisha.
Training with Aisha.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you weren't there that day.
No, I wasn't. No. Yeah. So that was the shadism bit. Right,
I really liked her use of, she used quite a few video clips as well that were evocative and helped us look and talk about things. I like the idea of doing that and bits of writing as well. So I definitely will be using that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, you read her book before you went on the course. I mean, many people wouldn't have done that. I mean, what did you find most powerful about the book, or the ideas in the book in particular?
Oh, it's just fantastic to have words to my feelings. That's how I felt.
Mm.
Have words to all the things that I'd felt, to see that I wasn't alone in this and my struggle. It really helped me. So in terms of the MSc course, it really helped me to accept that we are all in different places with this and we all struggle with it, all of us. You know, because I feel like I've done loads of work on myself.
Mm.
And here I am, still struggling.
Mm,
yeah.
You work as a trainer here.
Yeah.
And I'm imagining that you've incorporated some of the ideas that you've learnt over the years and with Aisha's training into the course.
Yeah.
What are the main difficulties in that area, do you think? I mean, what are the sort of... I know there are many, but maybe just one or two hurdles... that if they were overcome would facilitate an easier dialogue about race in training.
Yeah. Oh, well, I think one of the things is in my time that I've been teaching here with the awarding body, we had a whole essay looking at difference and diversity, and now we've got a criteria. So it's been cut to a criteria in a huge essay.
Oh, right, okay.
So in terms of importance of looking at these issues, it feels like it's way down the pecking order.
Okay.
Definitely.
So it's getting less so?
Getting less so, as if we've dealt with all these issues and we just need to say a paragraph on it.
Right.
Yeah. So if we were only looking at teaching to the criteria, then we would spend very little time looking at those issues.
Mm.
But we're looking at those issues... all of the I am trying to really incorporate looking at these issues all of the time through the training, bringing it up with everything
that
we talk about, rather than it being a bit that's stuck on.
Yes.
And we do have a specific slot for it, but we look at it a number of times and in a number of different ways through the course as well.
Right.
Yeah.
But as far as the criteria is concerned, there is one slot.
Not even a slot. There's one line.
Okay,
I suppose a student could write a paragraph on it. And I guess I'm talking about the certificate training, which is a one-year training of 140 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty sad.
Yeah. And not untypical.
Yeah.
And certainly my experience on my MSc as well, in the 3 years of the taught part of the course, I think we had one slot on it. Of course, it came up lots of times because I brought it up lots of times. Mm-hmm. And actually, my second tutor was very supportive. It made a huge difference because then our group could talk about the issues. She'd gone off and done research. A white woman, she'd gone off and done research.
Mm-hmm.
in Jamaica, in India, and she was able to talk about her research, the impact on her and her people that she supported. She's a supervisor as well. So
Why do you think it's getting less when it seems like there are more black students, more Asian students, more people of colour doing training?
How could it not be an issue? It's an issue for all of us. I suppose because black people are not part of the awarding bodies. They're not writing the criteria. The people that are writing the criteria don't see it as a priority.
Right.
Or want to tick a box.
I mean, there's a cycle, isn't there? I mean, in order to get more black people doing counselling, you need more black counsellors or Asian counsellors. And if the criteria doesn't quite meet them, then you won't get that many going through. So the status quo is we're happy with that. And it sounds like that's kind of how it is.
And because when we say more black and Asian counsellors, but actually more black and Asian counsellors that are aware and have a voice.
Yeah.
Have been empowered to find their voice, to really look at themselves. So I think, you know, there are black and Asian counsellors, but, you know, you think how many are not members of Barton and wouldn't associate themselves with Barton because they don't see the need, because they don't see the issues.
Yeah.
It's astounding, really, isn't it?
Well, it is.
Yeah.
It is. What made you go on this training? Was it just that it was there, or did something happen?
It's an ongoing, I was going to say project, but it's an ongoing lifelong quest looking at these issues. I'm wanting to work on a deeper level. I'm thinking about doing, so as part of my MSc, I have to do some research.
Yes.
It's a small research project. I have to keep reminding myself. But I'm really interested in doing some research on how to support tutors and students looking at these issues.
Yeah.
Continuing to look at that. And might do some research on myself and my own process around that. And I thought it would help me looking at that. But also because I'm generally interested and I'm looking at these issues all the time, not only with my training, but with my clients and my supervisees.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, are there other places that you go to look at these issues? Are there trainings that you've been on?
Where are they?
Okay. I was just kind of interested to know.
Yeah, where are they?
Okay.
I haven't seen any other training. I haven't, apart from the Barton stuff.
No. Yeah,
so, you know, I'm in a transcultural supervision group. I go to some of the Barton meetings. I try and always go to the conferences because I think they're amazing. But no, I don't see that there is that forum provided outside of Barton.
Right.
I don't.
I was thinking that maybe you might be able to help me out to find some more stuff like this, but I mean, because I don't know of any other place like this either.
And I think, you know, for years and years and years, my experience has been going to conferences and training and being the only black person. And really being silenced because of that. I wonder what I would be like now. Maybe not so silent. I don't know. It depends on the day.
So it's been a real journey. I mean, Aisha's book and the training is part of that journey. Obviously, you're doing other work outside of that. But it's all about finding your voice, isn't it?
And, and empowering others to find that. Because I'm finding my voice, I'm much more able to empower others to find their voice. So this year I had a black supervisee and I told her about... And she was doing training in a private organisation. And I told her about Barton and it was like I'd given her manna from heaven. She was so happy and thrilled and went to some of, I think she went to some of the support groups and came to the conference. And she felt very silenced on her call. She was the only black person and found it very difficult there.
I mean, what do you think might move the profession on? Do you have a sort of sense of what might loosen the grip around these issues to make them more important, make them feel more important, to be included on the training courses?
I think the things that we're doing, continuing to have a dialogue, getting our voice heard, continuing to meet, writing, I think definitely more black therapists, counsellors, trainers need to put things in writing.
Yeah.
Because then they're read across a whole wide spectrum. And I'd like to write at some point.
Just the dialogue.
The dialogue
out in the community somehow.
Yeah.
Through books, through I mean, through these podcasts, I guess.
Yeah.
And through the trainings.
Yeah. Yeah, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Rather than us just meeting on our own and it not going any further, because I think that's gone on for years and years. Mm. It's supportive, but actually, yeah. I think more and more black people are writing, but is it being published? I don't think so, not really.
Maybe there'll be a mad flood at some point. I don't know.
Oh, I hope so.
But I hope so.
If we keep writing.
Yeah, there's plenty of people I know who are ready.
Yeah. Yeah, which is very exciting.
Yes, yes. Obviously, we've got some people who are already doing that.
Yeah.
I should be in one. And obviously, if people go to the Barton website, they'll see some other people who have written as well. But yeah, certainly the more books in that area, talking specifically around racism, I guess.
Yeah.
And how that can be addressed. Some of the other people I've been talking to as part of this podcast have talked about finding the words.
Yeah.
You knew something, but you couldn't kind of put the words to it that you wanted to.
Yeah, definitely that was my experience when I was reading Aisha's book, that yes, I had the feelings, I had the experience, but I didn't have the words to express it.
Right.
And it feels like Aisha's book has provided a theory for me to hold on to, and maybe for other people to hold on to as well, for me to express myself in a way that other people who are not black and haven't had the experience can hear me.
Well, I think she's going to bring out another book, maybe some more ideas, maybe refining the ones she's already put together, and that's going to be exciting to see that.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about your experience of the training or generally around this area before we finish up?
I know that she offered some training at Metanoia and it wasn't taken up. And I find that really sad that that's still the case, that people are not booking themselves onto the training. And it's that whole thing of they don't have to, so why are they going to?
Mm.
And I think another way forward is for more courses to make it compulsory, that all students have to write something or have to produce something. In terms of them looking at themselves in dealing with these issues, whoever they are.
There's an ongoing process around dialoguing and communicating with the organisational bodies to make that possible. But
yeah.
That's been going on for a few years. That'll be a continuing dialogue, won't it? But yes, it does seem that might be the answer somehow to make that kind of happen in that way. Thank you for spending the time and letting us get a bit of an insight into your process around the black issues in the therapeutic process training.
Thanks for asking.
Thank you, Pat Marie.
Thank you.
That was Pat Marie Coleman, who is course tutor for the counselling program at City Lit, talking about the process of finding a voice around black issues. My second guest is Nikki Cooper. Nikki is the program leader for the professional qualifications department at an organisation called The Place to Be. This is a national charity providing emotional support to children in schools. She talked very openly and honestly about her process of coming to terms with her own discrimination and the history of racism that we all carry with us in our bones, as well as the process she and her students took to develop a conversation around race rather than to remain in agonising silence. I visited Nikki at her offices at The Place to Be. Thank you, Nikki, for agreeing to be part of this podcast. I know that you've done a specific training around black issues and you identify as a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to start off by asking, what drew you to top up your training in this particular area?
Well, I've been running the professional qualifications department here at Place to Be for a couple of years and had developed the postgraduate diploma from scratch, and I discovered from running that there was a great deal more for me to learn and understand. I had three particular students of colour on that first cohort of students who taught me a huge amount, painfully,
at
the time. And despite all our best intentions, the courses that we ran had always had a thread on difference and diversity. But despite that, what I realised from these three students, our training was still leaving some people feeling excluded or not understood or not properly heard.
Did they voice that directly
to you?
They
did, but it took time. Do you know what I mean? So it wasn't until the second year, really, that they were able to articulate that.
Yes.
Up until that point, it had been a lot of silence around it. But yes, by the second year, they found their confidence and their voices and were able to tell me what it was like for them. And I think the reason it had never been flushed out before is that all of our courses, other courses, are very short. And so it was the length of the postgraduate diploma that enabled the relationship to develop between us as tutors
right.
and the participants.
Okay.
And increased trust and honesty between us.
Yes.
So that then those things could be properly talked about, the conversation
right.
could be had. So
and you
I
were
learned,
working at a greater depth as
yes,
well, given the
yeah.
course yeah, length.
Yeah. And so that was a massive realisation, gosh, we've got an awful lot to do here. There's a huge amount missing. And I think I came face to face with my own ignorance and incompetence, really, as a result of having been a white middle-class woman who'd been brought up in this culture, completely immersed in it my whole life.
Right.
There was lots of things I didn't even know I didn't know.
Right.
You know,
right.
there was a sort of great well of not knowns.
Not knowing, yeah. When you're a very accomplished woman doing lots of things in this field, psychotherapy, but yeah, around this particular area you felt incompetent.
And yes,
the word. Yeah.
But I hadn't previously felt that. I've been quite kind of, I'm really committed to...
Yeah, yeah.
To equality and committed to anti-racist, anti-discriminatory practice, to the core of me, I was sort of convinced of it. But the experience of these three trainees
yes.
indicated that actually there was quite a lot that I wasn't addressing. So that was the driver for me to find out more.
Right.
So that was what drew me to it. I wanted to feel like our courses were going to be able to not just attract a broad diversity of people, but also that they would have an enjoyable, stimulating and inclusive experience of whatever it was we were up to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what drew me to coming on the Barton training.
Right.
And I wanted to find out more about myself in relation to racial and ethnic difference, really, because I just realised how little I'd actually thought about my own culture.
Right. I mean, had you done training in this area before?
Certainly not in
context?
my own counselling
right.
training. No, nothing. There was nothing about
okay.
anything to do with difference in my counselling training,
right.
apart from the training that I received when I joined the organisation,
yes.
which was our sort of our standard training, which is, it's good. It offered and asked the right questions
mm-hmm.
and things. But it's a lot better now.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if there were any fears around attending the training. What were your expectations? And I mean, how were those expectations met? Was it what you expected?
Actually, I don't think I had any fears
mm-hmm.
as such. The reason I came across it was because of your Day in the Life of in the Therapy Today
okay.
magazine.
Well, the article, yeah.
The article. And it had a very welcoming tone. So
yes.
I wasn't afraid. And also I think what I'd been going through for the previous 2 years in terms of confronting this as a tutor had been so difficult. I couldn't imagine that anything was going to be more difficult.
Oh, right.
It really had felt about as difficult as it could have felt in a personal way, as well as in a positive,
yes.
So it had had both ends of the spectrum. It had been exciting, but it had also been quite gut-churning
yeah.
a lot of the times.
So it sounds like you're saying that the students coming to you and kind of saying, well, we're not being met in this particular area, and that was in itself difficult.
Well, I think it was more that it was more in the process of not being able to say it that was painful. So it was towards the end. It was
once
the conversation could start to be had.
Yes.
And I think that meant everybody shifting themselves into a listening
right.
position
yes.
and an accepting position rather than a defensive one.
Yes.
Possibly
yes.
on my part and also an afraid part perhaps on theirs. I don't know. So we needed to spend time manoeuvring ourselves into
sure.
a place where they
sure.
could say, actually, we had a training where people were invited to do a sculpt of their experience of the training.
Mm-hmm.
And these three women had ended up apparently serendipitously together to make this sculpt.
Yes.
And they made a sculpt of the hear no evil, speak no evil, see no evil monkeys.
Yeah.
And it was the most, I don't know how to describe it. It was kind of, it was a massive breakthrough. But it, I mean, I'm even thinking about it now, I get goose pimples because it was such a kind of articulate moment, and the whole room completely froze because it was spot on. It was, yes, this is what it is. And that moment was a kind of real turning point for the group and for me, and a very exciting one. It sort of articulated the silence.
Yes.
Really, as one that wasn't being chosen necessarily. So I suppose up until that point, I'd felt that the participants were choosing not to speak.
Mm.
It kind of swiveled the lens round and made me think, okay, there's something about this course which is silencing, is having a silencing impact, and that's very troubling. So that was horrible and shocking, but it was also represented a big turning point, I think, for the group and for me and for them as well. And more conversations could happen after that, which were probably not as difficult as that moment. once the conversations could be had, it wasn't as agonising, I don't think.
Right,
so,
right.
And it was one of them who introduced me to Val Watson's work and Colin Largo, the two handbooks and
across
transcultural counselling. And so there was a particular chapter that resonated a lot with me, which was about ignorance of our own, of majority culture's ignorance of itself and needing to take responsibility for that, you know, and actually finding out more about all that stuff that's running in my veins and in my sinews and in my, whatever you call that stuff, bone marrow.
Bone marrow, yes.
You know, that absolutely everything was fraught with, you know, messages, beliefs, assumptions. And so that sort of generated more of a commitment to look at that, really. What did it mean to be a Bristolian, for example? My family comes from Bristol, and Bristol has got its own very particular history and culture.
Yes.
And my father's family have been there for a couple of generations, so I'm quite steeped in that mixture of guilt and defensiveness and division and all of that kind of thing. So it was really, so that was a big turn.
So it was a massive process, just to
so after doing there. That, the idea of coming on a workshop was actually can't be any worse than this. And I think I felt like this will be an event where I'm not in danger of silencing anybody by just being there. In fact, that wasn't quite the case, but it was still, you know, I thought, yeah, this is a place that I can come and listen, you know, and understand. Yeah, so I wasn't afraid of it. I hoped that I'd meet a broad mix of counsellors and trainee counsellors. I wanted to learn more about good and not so good practice in training, especially, you know, so I wanted to hear from people about what good things had happened to them in their trainings and anything.
Yeah.
Wanted to understand and gain a greater understanding about my own implicit attitudes and how they would feed into exclusivity in training. Yeah, I was aware that I'd be stumbling around and not getting it right, but resolved not to be silenced myself by that.
Okay, well, that's good. I mean, it sounds like, well, certainly in your training, and I know that's experience of other people on trainings as well, that's the silence means that people don't feel safe. So don't feel safe. If they don't feel safe, they're not going to explore. I mean, what was the safety versus exploration dynamic like on the course that you went to?
Well, I think it was named early on, which was helpful. So the potential for being gagged, you know, was there right from the beginning. And I think you said to me in a group, a small group that we were in, you said, I'm really aware of feeling anxious about you or feeling like I need to protect you or be careful about what I say. And so having that potential for you being gagged by me being there, and being able to acknowledge that I was probably the same, that I may be feeling anxious about what I said in case it upset anybody, meant that we had permission to stumble around and get it wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe. And in fact, there were a number of people who spoke to me and sort of said, "Are you okay? And how's it been? And you know, I'm not worried." And that was surprising. I sort of thought, I kind of thought, honestly, I'm fine, you know, and I really was fine. I didn't hear anything in that day that I found upsetting or, I mean, there was lots that was challenging, but it all felt very safe to me. It felt like people were thoughtful about what they said. They kind of processed it was digested, and it was put out there in a thoughtful way.
Mm.
I suppose it's uncomfortable to think that my presence could make things different. Mm. You know, it'd be lovely if I could just, you know, not do that. But then you sort of think, well, actually, that's the whole point, in a way, is that we're going to have an impact on each other, and it's being able to name that impact right from the start, so we know where we are in terms of how the conversation's likely to go.
So the likely process was talked about quite explicitly.
Yes.
Because we could have been talking about another subject, and these dynamics wouldn't really have been there. But certainly around these issues, then it really comes to the fore.
Well, I suppose because that's what we were there to talk
that's
about.
That's what we were there to talk about. So all those things, all those fears sort of come out at that moment.
Because that was on the agenda. If we'd been there to talk about transference and counter-transference, then perhaps that conversation wouldn't have been had. And perhaps it still needs to be had.
Yes.
You know, yes. In that. Yes. And I think the other thing that really struck me was... in terms of the actual experience, was that there was myself and one other white British woman there, and she's Jewish as well, so her, I felt like she was, you know, way down the line in terms of competence and wisdom than I was. But the thing that struck me was how much laughter there was on the day. I mean, there was much hilarity and thigh slapping and, you know, nods and quite a joyous kind of atmosphere. And what I was struck by was that whilst I understood every single word that everybody was saying, I didn't really get the jokes a lot of the time.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? I felt like a bit sort of voyeuristic. I was sort of thinking, if those perspectives are not part of my experience, so I don't get it. And when I came back after that training day, I bumped into two of the three women that had been on the first cohort, and I sort of said, this was my experience. I didn't get any of the jokes. And one of them went, yeah, yeah, that's it. There's a sort of... But I came away... really buzzy, you know, I kept with a real sort of, we can do this, you know, nobody died having the conversation, as long as you're naming the parameters from the start and saying, this is going to be really awkward, it's difficult, but let's have the conversation.
You would feel that, you'd probably feel outside of a lot of the jokes, especially, I think that's probably... would be normal, I think. Mm-hmm. It would be a normal experience.
But get some of the jokes, I laughed as well.
But you got something out of it.
A huge amount.
I mean, there was a lot of things, a lot of different areas covered. Mm. Was there one thing in particular, or was it many things? I mean, what gem sort of came out for you?
Yeah, things that have stuck. I think the one thing was that one of my students came along to the first one that I came to, and it was very early on in her training. So she was part of the third cohort.
Right.
So this was 3 years in.
Uh-huh.
By this time, I'd heard about what you were doing, and I'd recommended that she attend some of the Barton trainings.
Mm-hmm.
And so she happened to be on the same one as me. So together, we took a huge amount from it. We'd attended the same day, and we could feedback to the group together.
Okay.
And that had a massive impact on that group in terms of its willingness right from the beginning to tie in their thinking with an understanding that the theory, that counselling and psychotherapy theory is very, in itself, is very Euro-American and white, and that we can't assume that it's all, you know...
It's going to cover everyone.
It's going to get everyone. And so from the start, that participant, the young woman who was from Ghana, was able to say, well, actually, she had the confidence from the start to say, well, actually, that doesn't make any sense to me at all, you know, and she could be heard by the group. So that was a big impact for that group and on the training generally.
Yes.
Which had a big ripple effect backwards and forwards through all the trainings. But I think the ideas I came away with that really stuck was Aisha talks about ancestral baggage.
Yes.
Which normalises prejudice in a way, rather than demonising everybody, saying, you know, these people are deeply evil because they have these attitudes. Mm. It's sort of saying, well, we all carry around in our bone marrow and in our blood and in our skin and in everything, our histories.
Sure.
And it seems critical to me, in terms of it being a teacher, that the way to facilitate dialogue is to accept and normalise wherever you are on the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than going, oh God, I'm like, you know, God, I've just had a wicked, evil, racist thought.
Mm.
It's kind of going, whoa, where did that come from?
Mm.
I didn't know that was there. I need to think about that. And rather than beating myself up and saying, oh my God, I feel so ashamed, I'm so disgusting, I'm so terrible, it's kind of saying, okay, there's perfectly good reasons why that thought's there.
Yes.
There's a logical sequence of historical events that have led that thought to be deposited, or that attitude to be deposited in my mind.
Mm.
You know, now what? Now what do I do with that?
Yeah,
how can I change that? What conversation do I need to have with somebody else, or with myself, or with my therapist? Or
there's quite a long journey to be had before even the conversation starts.
Definitely, yeah.
There's a lot of stuff. You know, you want to be a good person.
Mm.
Who doesn't? And people genuinely come with that. And yet, there's these thoughts and feelings and stuff that just sort of appears in your mind, seemingly out of nowhere, horrifying stuff.
Yeah.
How do you reconcile the two of them?
Yeah.
Be a good person and have these thoughts. So it sounds like the idea of ancestral baggage has kind of made some sense out of why you can be a good person and still have the messages that are horrifying to you when you think about them. The general therapy community, regular trainings, trainings that I sat on, my colleagues sit on, and training that sort of I hear students going on, still haven't got to where you got to in your training. I mean, there are a few that have, but I think on the whole, my experience is, anyway, maybe someone might have something different to say about it, is that they haven't started the conversation around that within themselves, within the actual organisation. Do you have a view on it, why that is, what the main impediment is?
The difficulty about having the conversation is about, it's the paving the way thing. So unless somebody forces someone like me to have the conversation, then you don't think to have the conversation because you don't even know that there's a conversation to have.
Right, okay.
You know, so I suppose my position before all of this was, you know, well, I'm absolutely committed to you and you being entitled to everything that I'm entitled to. We are all absolutely equal. You know, that was my, you know, I absolutely have always believed that. And so it was very puzzling for me to have to take on board the idea that not everybody did feel that sense of entitlement. I didn't get why anybody wouldn't.
Yes.
You know, if you've been in this culture your whole life and you've been to school, and why wouldn't you?
Done the same things pretty much.
And so I think, so it was just a kind of non-conversation.
Yeah.
There wasn't anything to talk about. And if you've experienced any racist events in your life, then that's terrible and that shouldn't happen and that's dreadful, but nothing to do with me.
Right, okay.
And I think the step that I needed to take was to realise that I was part of the problem as well as being part of the solution.
Yes.
Not that it was my fault, not that I was entirely to blame for all the ills and evils in the world, but that my lack of understanding about my own culture meant that I was also part of maintaining a problem.
Mm.
And not to kind of go into a silent, guilty, self-flagellating, shameful place with that.
Yes.
Because that was a necessary phase as well. You know, what I should call the recognition trauma, you know, from the majority culture point of view of, oh my God, I'm such a terrible person, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's getting through to the other side of that and kind of, to the acceptance. So I think some of it's that there doesn't appear to be a conversation to be had. Well, not here anyway, because we're all lovely people.
Yes.
And so I think that's part of it. But then also, I think that historically, racial awareness courses and cultural awareness courses were remembered by people as being so traumatic and shaming.
Yes.
That people had a resistance to, maybe people have a resistance to go there again. I don't want to feel rubbish about myself. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Let's just all agree that we all love each other and we're all equal, you know, so.
I think you're right. I think there was lots that were gained through that process in the 80s and the early 90s.
Yeah.
No doubt about that. It left a residue in people's minds, I think, and you know, which is around.
And but that phase had to happen.
It did have to happen, too. Yeah.
I mean, it's like you have to shout really, really loud, don't you?
You do, yeah.
In order to get...
absolutely,
to be heard, really, and before the conversation. You know, everyone can settle down and start talking to each other. But in a way, I think the other way of looking at it, I mean, to encourage other, to encourage training courses, is that we're in an evolving profession. You know, it's not even 100 years old what we're doing.
Yeah.
And a place to be, we work with children, that's even younger, you know. We know nothing, you know, our understanding in terms of theoretical approach and all of that kind of stuff is all so spanking brand new, you know, and there's so much more to learn that if we're committed to evolving something that works, there's so much to be gained from thinking about other cultural perspectives on mental health, because we certainly haven't got it sorted up this end, as far as I can see, you know. So it's really exciting, you know, to learn about and think about other models and keep talking about them.
Yeah.
Of course, there's a willingness and a desire.
My experience is that there is a willingness and a desire, but I think you're right about, is there a conversation to be had?
Mm-hmm.
Is there another one apart from the one that we're having now?
Yes.
And if it is, well, what is it? I think you're right that there is that. It's not in the public consciousness that there is a conversation to be had. It's a bit of a revelation to find out that actually there is something to be spoken about here.
Mm.
And that sounds like it's quite often a painful journey.
Mm.
You know, who wants pain?
Yes.
No one, really.
Or awkwardness. Or getting it wrong or saying the wrong thing.
Yes.
But
it sounds like the time was right for you to take on board the students' thoughts and ideas. Your commitment kept you in the game and kept you listening, and it sort of has bared fruit.
Yes, some fruit, but we're not there yet.
Not there yet.
There's still a lot more to do.
Stuff to do still, but.
Yeah, but yeah, I suppose the proof of the pudding will be when we've got a workforce that accurately reflects the communities that we're working in.
Sure.
Then I think we'll know we've got somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I mean, thank you for letting us into the journey that you've made. Thank you.
Well, that's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Nikki Cooper, who is the Programme Leader for Professional Qualifications at The Place to Be, giving a personal and honest account of the process she and her students went through to develop a conversation around the issue of race. In summing up all four conversations, what seems to be common to everyone's experience is how silencing and shut down people feel when attempting to process Black issues in the therapeutic encounter. This silence is more than just not knowing, it's painful and agonising silence. This silence is often more painful than the conversation. What was also apparent was that putting the feelings into words and having concepts and ideas that make sense of what you're feeling greatly takes the pressure off and moves what feels confusing and overwhelming into the realms of the normal and the understandable, as well as the manageable. But what was also apparent listening to my four guests was that in order to bring people to the point where they feel there is an issue and there is a conversation to be had, there will need to be some level of making it compulsory for both trainers and students to look at themselves and their relationship to the issues of race and culture, both in the therapeutic dialogue of the course and in the written material and written essays. I'd like to thank all four guests for contributing to this podcast. I'm indebted to them and applaud their commitment and their passion. If you want to know more about the Black and Asian Therapist Network, you can visit the website www.baatn.org.uk. If you want to find out more about some of the concepts that were referred to by our guests, you can go to the articles page of the website and look for the articles by Dr. Aisha Mackenzie Mavinga. If you'd like to comment about this or any of the other podcasts, you can do so on the podcast page, or you can email me at eugene at baatm.org.uk. I hope you can join me for the next podcast, but until then, goodbye.